One of the greatest writers of the last century was Anton Chekhov, the Russian playwright, short story writer, who actually did not make his living as a writer, great as he was, but made his living as a physician. And as a doctor, he would see things, understand things about illness, about health, about human nature, that then allowed him such keen penetration in his writing. And Chekhov once observed that any disease that has many treatments is a disease that has no cure. Because if there's a cure, there's one treatment. And it's only when you don't know the answer that you give lots of answers, and that's not only true for diseases. It's true for whole categories of human disorders and questions and problems. There are thousands and thousands of diet books. Because no one diet seems to work. There are lots of allergy pills. Because if one worked for everyone, there would be a cure, there'd be one pill, and we'd be done with it. There aren't lots and lots and lots of tuberculosis vaccines, there's one. So whenever you find a question to which there are multiple answers, you know that no single answer is adequate. And I want to begin this morning, you may think I've already begun, but I'm actually going to begin now. That was the introduction to the beginning. I want to talk this morning about a question, a historical question, to which there are many answers, but I want to focus on one. And it is maybe the single most discussed question in Western history, which is, why did the Roman Empire fall? The greatest single work of a Western historian, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon, is devoted to this question. And there have been hundreds, literally hundreds, of answers given by distinguished historians. Everything from answers that have sort of been disproven, such as it was the ingestion of lead because they used lead in their pipes and so on, but that's been disproven because we have exhumed Roman soldiers and the lead in their bodies was no greater than the lead in yours. To the rise of Christianity, which was one of Gibbon's pet peeves. But since nobody knows, I want to choose one answer that Gibbon gives that has profound implications not only for Rome, but also for us. He said Rome eventually was conquered by the barbarians, because that's really how it fell, was there were tribes outside, especially Germanic tribes, who began to nibble away at the edges of the empire and conquer more and more and more, to the point where the most dangerous job you could have was to be the Roman emperor, because they died about every 2 years in war. The reason he said that that happened was the loss of Roman civic virtue. People used to care about each other in Rome, and they used to care about the Roman state, but gradually through affluence and indifference, they stopped caring about each other, they stopped serving the state, they became indolent and indifferent and narcissistic, and then destroyed. But the Jews didn't. Somehow, even though they lost their state, Jews continued to identify themselves as Jews, although, especially after 1453, which was the last of the last gasps of the Roman Empire, no one thought of themselves as Roman anymore. With the fall of Constantinople, it was all over. So how is it that Jews stayed Jews, this tiny people without a land, and this vast empire that covered so much of the globe was destroyed? And here you can see in our Torah portion part of the answer. Mishpatim reminds us that the essence of being Jewish is actually the cultivation of what we might call civic virtue. Think about the laws that we read this morning. You can't insult someone because they are a convert. That's a law of civic virtue. You can't insult a widow or an orphan or oppress a widow or an orphan. And you know why you can't? Again, to return to the Kotzker Rebbe, he said, because it's a double insult when you insult someone who's a widow or an orphan. It's a double hurt. Not only do you insult them, but you remind them that there's no one to protect them. They no longer have a parent or a husband who can stand up to you. And that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to hurt vulnerable people. Jews continually practiced this idea that we had to take care of one another. That it wasn't necessarily dependent on the government, because we went through good governments and bad governments, cruel governments, murderous governments, indifferent governments, and it didn't change the fundamentals of Jewish civic virtue, which is, if you're in trouble, I have an obligation to help you. In American law, you can step over someone in the street. In Jewish law, you may not step over someone in the street. Al ta'amod al dam re'echa. If you see someone who is in trouble, who is hurt, who is bleeding, who is hungry, you have a legal obligation in Jewish law to help that person. You cannot turn away. In our country, it varies. It's interesting, you know, when you watch the State of the Union address, it doesn't matter the president. He'll talk a lot about the government, but invariably, every president will point to some people in the gallery that are listening that exemplify this idea of civic virtue. Someone who does something selfless, something important in an attempt to knit together the polity to remind us that we're supposed to be one people. Someone sent me this week something quite wonderful about the terrible tragedy in Tucson that I want to read to you. This is America, where a white Catholic male Republican judge was murdered on his way to greet a Democratic Jewish woman member of Congress who was his friend. Her life was saved initially by a 20-year-old Mexican-American gay college student and eventually by a Korean-American combat surgeon, and all of them were eulogized by our African-American president. It's extraordinary. And that's a demonstration of civic virtue. That's a sense that, yes, we may be different from one another, but the obligation, the human obligation, the American obligation as one people remains strong. I thought it was a beautiful thing, though unsurprising, considering what wonderful families our B'nai Mitzvah come from, that both Benjamin and Brandon talked about the stranger in Mishpatim. Because that's what Judaism is built on. In fact, Hermann Cohen, the Jewish philosopher, said, in the stranger was Judaism discovered. The idea that when someone comes and you see that they're alienated, they're alone, they're strangers, they're hurt, that you will immediately embrace them. Ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, because we were strangers in Egypt. We know what it is to be a stranger. It's a civic virtue. No government can do that for us. No government can make me care about you if you're in trouble. No law, no constitution. But if you take the Torah seriously, it can. Why did Rome crumble? Because it wasn't built on the Torah. Because it was built on an administration and a government and an army and an empire, and we have discovered that all those things disappear. No army is forever. No empire is forever. Sooner or later, as surprisingly and suddenly as is happening in Egypt, the conflagration comes The fire devours, and that which we thought was forever is gone overnight. Remember how surprising and sudden and swift was the fall of the Soviet Union. And we're here because we built this sense of civic virtue, which used to be very powerful in our country, and in some quarters still is. But if you want to know how powerful civic virtue was in America, I want to remind you of something that I read a few years ago on the High Holidays, which, if you didn't hear it, you should, and if you heard it, you probably forgot. A few years ago, I was reading the memoir of the Hungarian Jewish historian John Lukács. And all of a sudden, he starts writing about the movie Titanic. And he says something that's incredibly important and powerful that almost nobody, in fact, nobody that I read who wrote about the movie mentioned. This is what he wrote. Of the many differences between the movie Titanic and history, one in particular is telling. In the movie, as the ship is sinking, the first class passengers, who are all third class human beings, scramble to climb into the small number of lifeboats. Only the determination of the people who are manning the lifeboats gets the women and children in. I don't know if you remember that, but that's the way it went. But in fact, he says, the Women and Children First Convention was observed almost with no dissension, particularly among the upper classes. In first class, every child was saved, and so were all but five of 144 women, three of whom chose to die with their husbands. By contrast, 70% of the men perished. In second class, 80% of the women were saved, 90% of the men drowned. The men on the first class of the Titanic made up a Forbes 400 of the time. John Jacob Astor, reputedly the richest man in the world of his day, is said to have fought his way to a boat, put his wife on it, and stepped back and waved her goodbye. Benjamin Guggenheim similarly refused to take a seat, saying, "Tell my wife I played the game straight and to the end. No woman shall be left aboard this ship," because Ben Guggenheim was a coward. In other words, some of the most powerful men in the world adhered to the unwritten code of honor, even though it meant certain death for them. And then Lukács writes the last line. The movie makers altered the story for a good reason. No one would believe it today. Can you imagine the barons of Wall Street doing that? Here, Mrs. Madoff, I'm stepping back onto the boat. It seems implausible. But these were men who not only were rich and not only built institutions, but they gave away millions upon millions to charity and never got a tax break, because there was no such thing at the time. But there was a powerful sense of honor and civic virtue. And the erosion of that sense is a greater danger to our country than any external enemy. As Jews, we actually do have something to teach. The principle of Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Vaze, all of Israel is responsible for one another, can be generalized. The sense that we are all in this together, that it matters whether you care for those around you, not only because it is the right thing to do, but is because the only way that a society can survive, that's what we learn from this morning's parsha. When we engage in tzedakah, not only for our people and for Israel, but for others in the world, including in our own country, we are engaged in a roundabout circle of self-interest. Only by caring, by giving, by protecting, by honoring, will we survive? This past week, I spoke at an all-faith service at the University of San Diego, which is a Catholic university. There were Buddhist Vietnamese chants, Native American dancing, Catholic reading, a Muslim recitation from the Quran, and the Jew talked. But I said that our fundamental belief is that God left the world unfinished, deliberately so, because we're supposed to finish it together. But we're supposed to finish it together, not as isolated islands of privilege, but realizing that the more you have, as in the story of the Titanic, the greater the obligation. Not the greater the exemption, but the greater the obligation. That's what it means to be a Jew. That's what it has meant traditionally to be an American. And if we keep to that, we won't go the way of Rome. Nothing is forever unless we make it so. That's the message of the Torah. So far, as a people, we have made it last forever. Since we know how to do that, let's see if we can teach it to our country and to the world. Shabbat Shalom.